Hi, welcome to Conversations with Erica and Nancy. I am Nancy Hendrickson, the author of Ancestral Grimoire, which just came out a couple days ago. And there's a copy right back there. You can kind of see the blue cover, and I'm thrilled with it. So I'll be quiet now and go ahead.
Congratulations on the book release. I'm Erica Robinson, Lenormandist and author. So obviously the subject of the hour or the 10 days, I guess, to come is that the whole world is watching is the death of Queen Elizabeth and the repercussions of that death and the repercussions of that life. And it's a subject that is not as clean and clear cut as some would like to think that it is, or as it is for some people. Obviously, as John Donne said, any man's death diminishes me because I'm involved in mankind. So we are diminished because of, there is a loss of life. There's a family grieving the loss of a mother and a grandmother and a great grandmother, a country mourning the loss of a monarch. But there's a whole nother side to the story that is also, I've been kind of happy to see, been given almost equal weight. And that is, what is the meaning of monarchy? And monarchy means different things to different people. And if you are coming from one of the empire countries, one of the countries that was colonized, used, abused, raped, pillaged, enslaved by the power that was England, you may feel a certain way. Again, maybe sad. I hope that we all feel sad because any person's death diminishes us. But also maybe I don't know, not torn up, neutral, or reflective of what the symbol of the monarchy is, as opposed to the person. So we've been talking, Nancy and I, between ourselves, about the concept of archetype and of national character. And so one of the things that we've noticed that the British are asking themselves is, who are we in the absence of Elizabeth? What does it mean to be British? What kind of king will Charles be, such that we can define ourselves according to him and who he is? And it got us thinking, Nancy, did it not, about the British character as opposed to the national American character. And so if the British archetype has been founded on monarchy or queenship or kingship, that's an archetype. Our archetype in this country has been founded on, if you think about the founding fathers, the visionary. Our founding fathers were, in fact, visionaries. And we've been talking about the fact that archetypes arise out of a certain need. And for England, that archetype of kingship has been like forever. Like, when was it not? Forever. So with the death of a monarch, this particular monarch whose reign was 70 years long, what a hard slog they've got to figure out who they are. And in talking about archetypes, you know, we can talk about our founding fathers as having been visionaries, but I remember the 60s, for example, which was a time of martyrs, right? Jack and Bobby and Martin and Malcolm and Medgar and all of those leaders who were murdered. And at the time, people would say, well, who's going to stand up? Like, who's going to stand for us next? In other words, who's the next martyr? And the answer to that question in the fullness of time has been answered, which is the time of martyrs, that archetype, came and went. It passed. And we've talked about the fact that in the United States, we've shifted a lot, just as the monarchy in England has shifted a lot. Is about to shift in terms of who are they. We're asking ourselves, who are we? If the archetype is not martyrs, if it's not visionaries, well, okay, what exactly is it? But there are many archetypes, are there not?
You know, as we talked earlier or yesterday, I started thinking back about American leaders. And I, you know, these are even before I was born, but I thought we do tend to pull archetypal people into our culture as a leader. And I'm looking back at Franklin Roosevelt, who was the savior from the Great Depression, Dwight Eisenhower, the protector, you know, Lyndon Johnson, the builder. We do tend to get archetypal figures, and I'll even pull Obama into that as also a visionary, but we are so drawn to the archetypal figures. That's who we want in charge. We want kind of the mother, the father, the grandfather, whatever the person is. And you said something that really hit home with me about, we talked about cults of personality.
Right.
And how, and I think it's just due a lot to our own pop culture and reality TV and kind of a whole slew of things that we don't have time to get into, but we are drawn to this cult of personality much more, I think, than the archetype, which is sad because then we're losing out to just the veneer instead of the core, if that makes sense. And your question to me was, as people are looking at this cult of personality, what is the truth of their hunger? What are they really hungry for? And we never finished that conversation, so I'm going to kind of throw it back to you.
Okay. So, you know, when we think of what the British are asking themselves, what will it mean to be British if we haven't got the Queen? I think that when we move this question to the United States and we look at, I'm just going to say it, race, and we have had all kinds of different looking people with different backgrounds, et cetera, but all of them have been set against the backdrop of whiteness, right? Whiteness has been sort of the backdrop, and everything is viewed over against that. But what happens when demographics, for example, shift, and white is no longer the backdrop, and white becomes the minority, so to speak? Well, then white, so to speak, has to figure out what the British are trying to figure out. Well, what does that even mean? What does it mean to be British? Well, I mean, what does it mean to be white? I mean, what is that white? I mean, what does that mean? I can say African American, and then I can go through a whole history of what that means and the, you know, what it means to be of that descent, et cetera. But white is just white. So you see people grasping for identity, calling themselves white, Aryan, whatever. But there's nothing underpinning it. There's nothing underpinning it. And I think that's why one of the reasons that we've shifted to this cult of personality. Like, I don't think there was a cult of personality back when the founding fathers were founding the nation. Visionary was the thing. It wasn't one guy. And even when it almost was one guy, George Washington said, yeah, no, thank you. You're not going to make me king for life. We're not doing that. So you're right. So I think that we're at this really interesting tipping point, because people are grasping for something. They grasped at Trump because Trump held up whiteness as a thing, as a virtue, as an identity. And so people's lesser angels allowed them to grab onto that. I do, though, think there is an accessible alternative for us. Just as I think, actually, that there's an accessible alternative for Charles. And I'll tell you what I'll tell you about Charles and that English alternative, and then we'll move it to the American sphere.
Great.
So Charles, as we, some of us who are of a certain age, remember, was laughed at mercilessly in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Why? Because he was seen as this crackpot environmental zealot. Like, what is wrong with you? What are you talking about? He was, however, at the forefront of ecological awareness. He sounded the alarm well before many, many, many people did, and took the slings and arrows of being perceived as this crackpot, weirdo, hippie in a crown guy. Now, he has said that he is constrained, because he's now the monarch, from speaking publicly on certain issues, because the monarch's not meant to do all that. I hope he carefully reads whatever their bylaws are in terms of what he can and can't do, and then finds a way around things so that, in fact, he can be a leader in this field. Because we're talking about saving the life of the planet. And what a cool thing it would be for England to kind of transform herself and redeem herself and be at the forefront of a movement led by a monarch to save the planet. This is not work that's alien to him. It's something he's done his whole life, and he could carry that small island nation, which, by the way, is about to lose all kinds of Commonwealth participants, you know, but they can be this little jewel that says, let's treat the earth like the jewel that it is, and let my monarchy stand for the forward movement of the world, as opposed to just England. He said, Charles, you know, he's the head of the Church of England, right? So he says, I don't want to be the defender of the faith. That's the term that he's known by, the defender of the faith. He said, I want to be the defender of faith. Well, that's quite a statement. And I think that would be quite consistent with saying, I don't want to just be king of England. I want to be the champion of the earth, of the earth. So that, I think there's potential there for them with that. In terms of the United States and this sort of cult of personality blip that we've had, because I kind of think it is a blip. For example, during the 60s, when we had the martyrs, we also had something else. And I just had brunch with my sister-in-law who reminded me of this. She and I both desegregated schools back in the day. And we did it with full awareness that that's what we were doing, that we were walking into sort of a lion's den experience, but we believed that we were doing it for the cause. And that's part of being a member of a visionary generation. I think that we're moving away from this cult of personality, or we have the potential to in this country, move away from this cult of personality and this cult of the two-party system to a more collective idea of what being a visionary means. And, you know, you and I talk all the time, our little tagline thing that we say is, you know, a more perfect union, right? And we also emphasize, we're not talking about this only in a national sense, but we're saying that the personal is political, that it's about making a more perfect union with yourself, right? So how could we do that? Well, maybe if we start to shift our thoughts or our perceptions of ourselves to being, you know, not sycophants of a cult personality who comes down a golden staircase, because that whole thing was weird. I'm just saying, it was weird. But I think there's a way for us to look at ourselves as visionaries / healers, and to start with ourselves. I saw a beautiful Facebook post by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, I love her voice. I listen to her to go to sleep, and not because she's boring, but because she is such a comfort. Her words are such a comfort. And she's a very interesting person, born to poor Mexicans and then adopted and reared by poor Eastern European immigrants. And so she tells this story about her adoptive father talking about a single dice. Yeah. And, you know, how many sides does it have? It has six. So you put the die down on the table. You can only see five sides of it. The sixth one is always hidden. Now, let's say that someone's a terrific person. Well, that's great, because you can see that in one of the five sides that you can see. And you know, we all have sides of us that are not wonderful, but maybe mostly what shows is goodness and compassion and strength and all of that. But what happens if someone presents, a single person presents as just a straight jerk? Even, let's just take as an example, the orange one. Even the orange one has six sides, metaphorically. There is a side that we don't see, you and I, maybe other people do, I don't know, we don't see, which is the side that the die is lying on. And we don't see it, all we see is the ugliness. But that hidden side, if we believe that everyone has the spark of the divine in them, that everyone comes from the source, which is God, that hidden side, that underneath, that's that golden side that connects even the orange one to source. And so could it not be that we say, okay, well, we're not going to be a monarchy, and the two-party system, I don't know, that's not really working for us. And look what happened January 6th, and families are torn apart, and brother hates brother, and all. Can we not start with ourselves in creating this more perfect union? How can I heal myself? How can I have a vision for how I want my life to be? And then can we not broaden that so that the archetype that we participate in is not the kingly one, it's not the martyr one, but it can be, we can remake the visionary one that we all participate in, so that we can all be healers and visionaries. I mean, I do think we can do that. I don't think we're stuck. Like, first it's the era of this, and then it's the era of that, and then it's the era of that. I think we can broaden the perspective, you know, and that there are people already who do this, and they can be models, but they're not the kind of models where you say, okay, I see you're modeling this, so you go ahead and do that, and I'll sit back and watch. What the models are modeling is how to do this in a participatory way, right? So we create this more perfect union with ourselves, and then become, as a nation, the nation that we need to be. Because I don't see the two-party system working too well. I think that the whole world is going through this big shift. And I think instead of looking at it as, oh my God, we're going to hell in a handbasket, I don't know. I'm kind of excited because there's an opportunity to look at that bottom side of the die and see what's under there and maybe pay more attention to that than to the other five sides. What are your thoughts?
Oh, totally. But you know what? It does take courage. Mm-hmm. It does take the desire to have a more perfect union, not only governmentally, but individually. And going back to what you said about Charles, who, you're right. I mean, he's been preaching the environment for 50 years at least. But he also is the monarch of a constitutional monarchy and a constitution that's gone back God knows how many hundreds of years. So it is going to take the courage and the willingness and the understanding that status quo is not working.
Exactly.
Status quo is not working, whether it's in England or here. And the Constitution has to be changed. And people are so afraid of losing the status quo. So look at us, two-party system. The years we've had a third party run have ended up being less than perfect. Let's just say that. Right. I'll go back to the Al Gore,
right,
Ralph Nader thing and the Ross Perot. I mean, all that a third party has done in America is draw votes away from the party they are closest to. It's not a true third party. As in France, that are many parties that are very different from one another. So we at least, I'll give America credit, we at least have passed amendments to a constitution that we know did not work in a certain period of time. It was outdated. It was outdated. It worked in the period of time and it was visionary. The founding fathers created a form of government that had not existed. And it was brilliant, and it was brilliant for the time. And so now we're looking at, okay, England, do you guys have the courage to look at the constitutional monarchy and say, okay, maybe the king or the queen needs to be able to actually be more participatory in policymaking? I mean, that's a huge leap. And then you have to go back. Do the people in Britain want the king or the queen to be involved in policymaking? Do they then become like an American politician? Maybe they are very happy to have that person up on that throne and not involved. You know, and all the things you hear about Queen Elizabeth II is that she kept her opinions to herself. And it's always lauded that she did.
Right.
So they may not actually want the monarch to be a policymaker. We don't know.
We don't know.
No, we don't. And do we want a true third party, fourth party in America? Because we have seen really kind of a perfect union that was created with the Constitution and the amendments, but we never conceived of a situation where we could have a leader of the Senate, a president, an attorney general, corruption from top to bottom. We've never seen it, and the founding fathers never envisioned
right.
That.
You know, on one hand, there is something really charming and naive and hopeful about the fact that that was unforeseen, and about the fact that for all of the foibles that and sins that have been committed between the time of the founding and now, we had a certain level of agreement that we would follow certain protocol or certain rules, or that You know, that's all gone kind of out the window is the problem.
Well, it is. And it was naive, but charming. And as an English major, you know that if you have several things in a sentence, you tend to put the most important one at the end. And so you look at the signers of the Declaration when they're saying that they're pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that was the important part of that sentence is those people who could pledge their sacred honor, that actually meant their sacred honor. That didn't mean until the next election rolls around.
I have
to scrub my website of all my anti-abortion stuff to get elected again.
Exactly. What is sacred honor now? I mean, what does that even mean to people? That's right.
Yeah. So I want to go to, and we can continue this, but I want to just throw in the card that I drew today because we've talked a lot about archetypes, and I have a deck called the Archeo, which is a deck of archetypes. And I just asked, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes. I asked, what can we as individuals seeking a more perfect union with ourselves, what is an archetype that we can best walk? And one came up that I really did not expect, and it was called the fatalist. And we have a very negative connotation, I think, for fatalism. And yet this card speaks to the ability to understand that life really is a wheel. And I'm not talking about the wheel of fortune. I'm talking about the wheel, that some days we are smooth sailing, some days are bumpy as hell. The fatalist recognizes that for every Mother Teresa, there's a Stephen Miller. The fatalist recognizes that. But as the person who wrote this book really brilliantly said, is that the fatalist ignores the machinations of small-minded people and makes the right choice, the better angel choice. And so to help form our more perfect union with self, we're being asked to ignore the machinations of the small-minded people, to understand that life is a circle, a wheel, and that is it's up to us to stay on our kind of smooth path by making the right choices for us, for our lives, that listen to our better angels, but not to be so naive as not to recognize the Stephen Millers of the world. And if you don't know who Stephen Miller is, go Google him.
When I think of that card, and I mean, obviously this is just me because I didn't create the deck, and I think of that word, the thing that came to my mind was the idea that, you know, fatalism, I think, implies a certain, well, and not unlike what you said, a certain resignation. So here's the resignation that you just met, yeah, that for every good, there's a bad. You have to be resigned to that fact. But I also think it's about being resigned to the fact, and when you talk about a wheel, that there are things that are very appropriate and timely and they work, and then their time passes.
Right.
And you can't try to pull them out of the grave because, you know, all you'll pull up is a corpse that you have to let go and move to the next thing. And I think that's important.
But which is exactly what, and going back to what you said at the very beginning, which is exactly the people that Donald Trump appealed to, is they wanted to pull up the whiteness of 1950, 1940, 1930, yes. 1790. Is that they were trying to pull up a corpse.
And look what the corpse that they got. Now, I pulled three Lenormand cards in sort of conversation with your,
fatalist.
With your fatalist card. And I quite like what I got. So I pulled from the Lenormand Revolution, because are we not talking about revolutionary times, you know, both in present day Britain and also in our own country. The three cards that I got were the cross, the ring, and the house. So the cross, let old things pass away. Let old things pass away. Stop trying to yank the corpse out of the ground. Like, I mean, let Elizabeth go rest with Philip. Do we need to parade her around the whole country in the box? I mean, let old things pass away. And be committed to building your house that you can live in, that's got a good foundation, that is solid, that is more perfect than the one that has passed away.
You couldn't have drawn three more perfect cards.
No. Isn't that always how it happens?
It is always how that happens. So I am going to glide us towards the end of this by thanking everybody for being here, asking people to subscribe to our podcast if it's something you think you would like notifications about. And just, you know, Erica and I never really know where we're going with these conversations. So thank you for going along on the ride with us. I much appreciate it.
So do I. Thank you.